we had no more funds effectively. And a few months in, I was like, hey man, I don't think we can afford to pay you anymore. So you're a volunteer at this point. If you stick around, I'll make sure that I'll do you right and that we'll pay the salaries back with interest. Thankfully, everybody stayed. Not a single person quit.
Welcome to Backstage of Millionaires, the show where we bring you the stories of real Indian startups told by the entrepreneurs that build them. I'm Caleb Friesen, and on the show today, how Tushar Vashish took his startup Healthify.me from a simple calorie tracker to a global health tech empire with more than 30 million users worldwide. For many of us, the idea of losing weight oscillates between feeling totally achievable, especially on New Year's Eve when we promise ourselves that I'm going to get fit this year, to feeling absolutely impossible. And the way that our lifestyles are set up doesn't really help with this feeling. We live in a world of desk jobs, long commutes, Netflix, and near limitless access to junk food. More than ever before in human history, we are sedentary, and that means that as a human race, we're gaining weight faster than ever before too. And this is the exact problem that Healthify.me has set out to solve. Using their app and the access to professional coaches that come with it, customers can get back in shape using nutrition tracking and diet planning, and the company also offers hardware like CGMs, that's continuous glucose monitoring sensors, and smart scales for tracking weight. Today, the company has a presence across multiple countries, generates millions of dollars a year in revenue, and has raised more than $100 million in external capital from investors. But in the early days, Healthify.me was just a simple calorie tracker website. Tushar Vashisht had been working at Deutsche Bank throughout his early and mid-20s, first in San Francisco and then in Singapore, and he felt pretty fit and healthy. But he also missed home, and so in 2010, he shifted back to India, where he quickly realized that the healthy food options he'd grown accustomed to weren't as accessible in India as they were abroad. In fact, he ended up gaining 20 kilos during this chapter of his life, which largely consisted of him contributing to India's unique ID project, today known as Aadhaar.
I remember my mentor and the guy who kind of got me into Aadhaar was Raj Mashruwala. He was the, one of the earliest guys out there. And I was living with him in the apartment where Aadhaar was founded, literally. So amongst the first four tasks that I had on my first day, one of them was fill up all the water bottles. And the second one was, please fix the microwave. I never succeeded on the second task. I gave it to the next guy who came in. And I don't think that microwave was ever fixed, by the way. But it was doing everything from literally filling the water bottles to building the enrollment strategy for Aadhaar and, building the workflows on how the system will go, or partnering with McKinsey to figure out what the business model would be, or, different states, chief minister offices, or the public distribution system. So it was kind of everything. It was just 10 people handling whoever could do whatever in the early days.
It's amazing to think back all that. Just 10 people. I mean, now it's ubiquitous. It's just like part of being Indian is Aadhaar. But at that time, it was you and 9 other people. Was that the reason, though, in 2011 that you kind of walked away? It had gotten so big that you felt like maybe your contributions weren't as meaningful, or was there another reason why you decided to leave?
When I had joined Nandan, I think, and Raj, my commitment to both of them was that I'd be doing this for 2 years, because it was at voluntary levels or near voluntary levels. So it was an impact, sort of a, government mission for me to accomplish or help out on. So I had that 2-year deadline coming in. And I think every 6 months, as the scale got larger, and as more and more of the uncertainty got lower and stability got higher, I think, I wanted to move on to something that would continue to drive that level of excitement and impact.
Yeah, which is exactly what you did. 100 rupees a day project, which I'm just curious, I think most people don't wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to go starve myself, right? Or I'm going to try to live how many people were living at that level back in 2011?
We were ourselves quite surprised that 74% of the country was living less than 100 rupees a day.
Wow.
X of rent. And this is on an individual level, right? So that is about 200-300 rupees of median household income or mean household income that we had discovered, excess rent. And you know, I think it was certainly not a weight loss diet or a regimen. I think the way it sort of got to be is that for almost 2 years, I was working for the average Indian, right? At Aadhaar, the purpose was to help the average Indian get access to government services, to benefits, to infrastructures, identity. So we had traveled, me and my co-founder, Matt, we had traveled through the length and breadth of the country. You know, I had gone to villages where you couldn't access via road and, you know, beyond a certain point. And lived there and stayed there. But I always felt that I was doing this from a bubble, right? Everywhere we'd go, we could fly there, we could drive down in cars and stay in government guest houses. And it was a fairly sheltered life. So it was almost like going and observing through a glass, you know, air-conditioned room about how India is really operating.
You've heard of this concept of like poverty tourism?
Yeah, I don't think it was...
I'm not saying it was like that,
It was research into India that we were doing, frankly. But I felt that research didn't feel as genuine as living it. And so I felt that it would be disingenuous if I didn't conclude my, you know, nearly 2 years long, you know, meditation on India with an actual experience. You know, and by then I had been armed with a very good perspective from within about the government, about policies, about... the way, you know, I was responsible for working with the public distribution system, with the oil and gas system, with the financial inclusion system. So I was, you know, deeply familiar with various aspects of Indian machinery. I just wanted to make sure that I actually break that glass wall and kind of experience being like the average Indian myself. So I literally walked across to my roommate and he's like, hey, listen, you know, I've kind of been thinking that it'll be incredible to actually experience what an average Indian experience is, rather than coming from this, you know, privileged Ivy League life that we've come down from and you know, just observing, we wanted to experience. I think that would be a good finale. And if we could write about it, that would be even better. And he was, you know, without even blinking an eye, he's like, sure, that sounds exciting. Let's do it. And we never expected us to go down to live at the poverty line. But during the experiment, the government came out with the definition of the poverty line as 32 rupees a day. And we figured that while, you know, we're living on the 100 rupees a day constraint, might as well go down to the 32 rupees and experience what those constraints are all about. And turns out that was 37th percentile. So a third of our country lives below or lived below 32 rupees a day. And we felt that it's only fair that if we experience the 75th percentile, let's go experience the 37th percentile. And after that, it would hopefully leave us with a significant sense of empathy about the country that we live in.
Yeah, for sure. So Matthew ended up being your first co-founder in Healthify Me. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious to know, how did you go from that point where you're kind of blogging, you're documenting your 100 rupees a day experience to 32 rupees a day for the last week, I think. Mm-hmm. How did that go from... I guess it was like an Excel, you were tracking the food that you were eating and the cost. Is that how it transformed into Healthify Me, sort of calorie tracking? Like, I'm curious to know what the story is there.
So I think me trying to lose weight by calorie quantified self space was independent as a trend. And me living on that income level was probably a catalyst to design something for the Indian lifestyle. So when we were done with the experiment and as we were thinking about what to start up, we were both very keen on starting up, on building something that delivers impact as a huge part of its collateral. So we were looking at healthcare, we were looking at education as two areas where we felt that, you know, no matter what we do, it's going to create fantastic outcomes and impact. And as we were toying around with ideas there, you know, when people would ask us, hey, what do you use to track those protein, fats, carbs, and nutrition and stuff? And we'd often point them to our Excel. You know, to help out people, we kind of put that Excel into a Google Sheets. Google Sheets were new at that time, but we're like, hey, you know, you can use it. You can track it too. You just, you know, type in your food and it'll pull up from some VLOOKUP, HLOOKUPs of the Excel sheet and give you its output. You know, it was less than a few hundred foods that you can track. And we saw that there were like literally hundreds of people using it at some point because we used to talk about our experiment and then people would ask for the sheet and, you know, give the link just to help people out. And then people were literally using that to track their lifestyle and there was a demand for it. So we figured, listen, while we still think of what we're going to build, why don't we just convert this thing into a website? It's just so much better and less clunkier for people, because, you know, somebody would delete something, somebody would come and edit something out, and it wouldn't work. So we thought, oh, okay, let's just convert this thing into a website, and then we'll see from there. And, you know, I think that website is still continuing.
There you go, yeah.
It's now an app, and there are a lot of people who use it. Hmm. But it just snowballed into becoming a startup. While we were still thinking of what to build, I think this just took a life of its own.
Right. So kind of almost like entrepreneur by accident. It was just sort of a natural thing that grew out of this experiment that you had.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it started in Kerala, sort of in a small way, but then eventually you were back in Delhi. I think you were staying at a friend's dad's farmhouse or something. I know you're originally from Haryana, I think, mm-hmm. right? So was it somewhere around there, or like what, I mean, what did it look like at that early stage? It was just you and Matthew, and you're just building this website?
So before I went to University of Pennsylvania, I used to study at Delhi College of Engineering and then Delhi Institute of Technology, known as NSIT now. So we'd just go hang at some of these colleges and try and, you know, recruit interns. And yeah, a couple of kids, Simran and Rohit, we met them at the administrative block and told them, hey, we're building a school website. If you guys want to come in, you know, we'll probably give you, food and drinks and, and some extra cash if we have some, but, you know, come hang out, come stay with us if you'd like. So they literally relocated up to our farmhouse. They came up, our place was actually just south of Delhi, and they really loved it out there. And, you know, we used to basically hang out with these two kids. And then Vishnu, the son of one of our friends out here in Bangalore, was in between his college and his medical school in the US. So, you know, he figured he'd heard about us, he'd followed our experiment. So he said, hey, I'd love to join in too in this fun you guys are having. So, you know, four or five of us, we'd design stuff, we'd work out together, live together, design stuff together. And, and soon we had a website.
Okay, so I just wanted to take a break here to talk about today's sponsor, Jungle Ventures, because I think that there's tons of gyan online about how to start a startup, things to avoid. All of this stuff is from the founder's perspective, but what there isn't a lot of content on is how VCs look at startups. For example, what do they look for before investing, and what are some of the red flags for them, or just advice for founders in general? And this gap is what Jungle Ventures is trying to fill through their YouTube channel. And one video that I want to highlight here in particular is this video where they actually explain what a down round is.
We believe that survival is the most important thing for a business, followed by product market fit, and then having enough cash runway to prove your product market fit, as well as keeping yourself and your team healthy and motivated. And therefore, if a down round is a necessity, then you would have to raise it.
So if you enjoyed that clip and you want to watch the full video, you can find a link to it in the description down below. And while you're over there on Jungle Ventures' YouTube channel, make sure to hit subscribe as well, because they're regularly posting that kind of high-quality content. All right, now on with the podcast. I'm just curious, though, because there's like a 5-member team now at this point, and you did say food and drinks, yes, so relatively inexpensive. But still, I mean, money has to come from somewhere, right? Either you're paying rent, or you're buying the food or whatever, just to keep the lights on. So was it sort of like you're dipping into your own personal savings from your Deutsche Bank days and you and Matthew, or asking money from family and friends? Like, how were you keeping things going?
So we'd committed to spend some money. I think I had committed to put in about 10 lakhs at the outset, and Matt, like, I think a couple of lakhs. And, together we had this little pool of capital that we had put in. And
were you planning on staying in Delhi long term, or was Bengaluru always something that you had on the horizon?
We found ourselves, actually the pivotal moment was that we got accepted into the Microsoft Accelerator, which was based out here, and one of their conditions was that at least during the accelerator you have to be here. So we moved back and we lived with people who would be willing to give us rent-free accommodations for a few months, and worked at Microsoft Accelerator.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's when we locked in our angel round, our first round of capital, 1 crore rupees, which were like an insane amount of money at that time. And then that's when we started recruiting, you know, talent. We converted those interns into full-time employees. We had to actually talk to their parents to convince them to join us, because their parents were like, I think one had a job at Samsung, the other had a job also at some big company, and you know, we had to convince their parents as to why they should let their kids join this uncertain, unknown, this couple of people's, you know, in Bangalore instead of Delhi.
Yeah. So yeah, you raised that 1 crore angel round from a couple of people at Aadhaar. I think you had mentioned their names earlier as well.
Yeah, Raj Mashruwala really helped anchor the round.
And Sashi.
He was my boss, basically, at Aadhaar in a big way. And so he kind of also helped me anchor the round. And then a bunch of people joined. Sashi Reddy, actually, I'm having lunch with him after this today.
Oh, there you go.
And he joined in as well at that time. Mm-hmm. He was not at Aadhaar, but he came in because of his friend Srini. And both of them used to invest in angels at that time from Hyderabad. And, you know, I was connected to Srini because of Microsoft Accelerator. And I still remember that day when there was a friend's wedding in Hyderabad. So I'd gone for that. And between the wedding, I'd, you know, gone to meet Srini in an auto and at this cafe coffee day. And I remember I wanted to show him a demo of the website.
Oh, the website wasn't up yet?
It was flaky. It was up, but, you know, it didn't necessarily work all the time. It was not launched beyond its alpha version. It was not commercially there. It was sort of just a barely working beta that was, or rather an alpha that was in place. And, you know, I remember hearing from Matt and the other team out there, be like, hold on, you can't demo yet. Wait a minute, like, let us know. And then I'm talking to Srini and I'm continuing to talk. And then I'm checking on the other side in my WhatsApp or whatever it was at that time. You know, guys, is it up? Can I demo it now? And then be like, okay, you can do it now. And then, you know, I'd show him and, yep, it worked perfectly fine as a demo. And then, you know, and I remember texting them, okay, it's done. They're like, okay, thank God. You know, everybody relaxed at the back.
Shut down the servers.
Shut down the servers. So Srini told me later he invested in me or the company, not because of anything else, but apparently because of a good follow-up I did. So I went back home right then, you know, wrote him an email, talked to him about the next steps, about the vision, about what we're trying to do, how we're going about it. And he felt it was very articulate and well-timed. And that was the thing that actually got him excited, which was surprising. You know, I thought it was the product demo, but really it was the follow-up.
Yeah. I mean, investors, I've heard this a lot, that they invest in people first. So going back to Microsoft Venture Accelerator, that was also a really important time, I think, for you, and because you met your other co-founder. I think there was a bit of a gap, right, where Matthew had gone back to the US. I guess he had to walk away from Healthify Me for some personal reasons. Mm-hmm. And so you were like a solopreneur for a little while, right? Before you met your co-founder, Sachin.
I was solopreneuring it, not really to a large extent, because Sachin was right there. And Matt was actually, involved in helping recruit Sachin as well into the whole vision. So Matt made sure that there was continuity and that, you know, the company would be in good hands.
That's huge.
That is massive. Actually, many early stage startups suffer from movement of co-founders. There's something I've seen now as I invest in angels as well, is that one out of three co-founders will, on an average, leave. And I think that's completely fine. It's at a very early formative stage. And, you know, people are defining their interpersonal equations and also understanding if this is for them or not. And it's normal for that movement to really happen before it stabilizes somewhat.
Yeah, especially when they're in their 20s and there's
absolutely
so much,
right. There's just so much of uncertainty in life. But I think the good co-founders do it amicably, and they do it in a way that ensures that the company goes into a good place, regardless of, you know, personal outcomes. You always put the company first.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think you guys would have been, what, you were 27 at that time?
Yeah, I think I was 26 or something like that.
Yeah. And whereas Sachin, I think, was a little bit older, right?
Yeah. He was the adult in the room. He was in his mid-30s and...
Had kids.
Ex-Google.
Yeah. Had quite a bit of experience under his belt.
Yeah, yeah.
I've heard that he was sort of like an engineering or like coding guru. Like he was just like a genius. When he joined, everybody was just shocked by what he was capable of.
Yeah, I mean, I still think he's an engineering genius. He certainly was back then. And relative to complete freshers and interns and people who hadn't really built production systems before of any scale, you know, he was like an absolute, you know, level 10 guru of sorts. I remember one of the first few things he did at some point, I think about a month in, he was like, okay, Tushar, I hate to tell you this, but I'm going to do, you know, RM minus RF. It's like, okay, wait a minute. You're going to do what? He's like, I'm going to delete all the code. I'm rewriting this shit. You guys have built something that's not going to scale beyond a few thousand people. And it's okay to demo the website, but this is not a production system.
Yeah. He was like an expert at building things for scale, right? He had worked on Gmail, exactly. I think also Orkut.
Yeah,
I don't know if I'm saying that correctly. We didn't use it in Canada when I was growing up.
Yes, yes, exactly.
So very experienced.
You know, I think you need experience, but you also need some level of foolishness to, I think, get a startup going properly. You know, because I think while he brought in a lot of experience for building for scale, fundamentally his approach would be left by himself would therefore be slow in its nature, right? Because you're really building for mass millions of people scale. And because I didn't know any better, my approach was, let's launch yesterday. Let's break things. Let's move fast. I mean, we can't keep waiting and, you know, time's running out. And so I think that created this healthy tension, you know, where me and Sachin would often fight about deadlines and timelines, where my timeline was always yesterday. And he wanted to make sure that he builds a system which is 99.9% stable. My threshold for stability was far lower because I was coming from a place where the stability was 50%. So, but that healthy tension between two co-founders is very, very good.
Definitely. And in spite of the hard work, I think that both of you guys and the team were doing, it seems like that 1 crore rupees sort of disappeared within a certain span of time. You ran out of money. And it seems like the website just wasn't seeing the kind of traction that you guys were hoping for. What was that time period? I think that was what, sometime in 20?
In March 2014, I think, March or April 2014. You know, we had no more funds effectively. And of course, I was trying to raise. I had a couple of term sheets withdrawn from me at that time, you know, a term sheet that I couldn't secure. So it was a really difficult time when funders were being anxious. There is no revenue model. We had a good team. We had a phenomenal product. We had high engagement. And we had customers, real tens of thousands of people who were using us and loving us for our product. That love and those testimonials, I think, kept us going during that time.
For sure. Were you still at Microsoft Venture Accelerator?
No. We were out of Microsoft by early 2013.
Yeah.
So this was just us by ourselves.
You had your own office in
we Bengaluru. Had a place called Hoffice. It was basically a house in Indiranagar, which we'd converted to an office. And we were sharing it with another startup. So we had about, the total space was 1,500 square foot. And I think we were using 750 of it.
Okay.
750 square foot in like a little terrace where we were huddled in. And, you know, I remember our board meetings used to happen literally on the terrace. And our conferences were open air conference rooms, which we used to call them. Open air conference was, you know, go out on the terrace and have a chat.
Yeah.
Difficult conversations were carried out on walks. So when I said, hey, I need to take you out for a walk, it was like, hey, it's going to be a tough conversation that I need to have with you.
Get away from the rest of the team.
Yeah. So, you know, but that's how we managed our early days. Our rent was, 20,000 rupees a month or something, 15,000 rupees a month.
I heard that your desk was just like right next to the front door.
That's right.
And people would like, because right now you have a beard, you look very adult-like, but I think at that time people would walk in, see this young guy, clean shaven, and they'd be like, oh, it must be the secretary or something.
Yeah, so my desk was literally was supposed to be the secretary's desk right there. It was the reception desk, basically, and you know, that was the one place I could isolate myself from the rest of the guys, so I just kind of sat there. And it was also right next to the toilet on the floor. So if somebody had to go use it, they'd go behind me. So it was a particularly weird place for me to be, but that was the only place that was isolated from others. So I kind of, you know, I had my own little zone over there where I could take calls and do my things. But yeah, it was pretty funny. People used to come up and be like, yeah, I've come. I remember people in suits would come down sometimes from Unilever or wherever else we were trying to partner. And they'd be like, hey, so is this the Healthify office? Can we meet the team? And be like, yep, this is the Healthify office. I'm the founder. let's have a chat. You know, let's sit over there.
Wow.
Yeah. But yeah, that was how the first 2-3 years were. We did run out of money, but thankfully everybody stayed. Not a single person quit.
What was it? 20, 30 people?
About 20 people by then.
20 people. Yeah, that's incredible that everyone, and this was like a 3-month period where you weren't able to pay. I think it went down to like 30% cut of salary, and then it was kind of like, no, we still don't have any money in the bank, so sorry, guys.
That's
hope
exactly
you stick
right.
with us.
No, I remember Rohan joined us as a designer, and I remember literally in the second week, I told him, hey, bud, everybody's taking a 30% cut. And, you know, he poor guy was already at some 25,000 a month, and he went down to like 18 or 17. And then a few months in, I was like, hey man, I don't think we can afford to pay you anymore. So you're a volunteer at this point. If you stick around, I'll make sure that I'll do you right and that we'll pay the salaries back with interest the moment, the instant I can secure it. And everybody kind of understood that it was a place of, you know, of from a very genuine place that we were saying this. And I also said, if somebody really badly needs some capital for something, tell me and I'll try and figure it out. So I took some personal loans at that time. I remember paying for one of our employees' wedding expenses. I remember paying for somebody because he broke a hand. He was in a hospital. So I remember paying that bill. And all of it was coming through like borrowed money from friends and family. So it was really sort of, in hindsight, if I look back, it felt like a dark time, but it just didn't at that time. Again, it was tough for sure. I think the first time a founder runs out of money is definitely very difficult. But most people don't anticipate that, of course, you're going to run out of money at least once, maybe twice, before the company goes somewhere. I think running out of money is a rite of passage almost as a founder. And most people think it won't happen to them. But if anybody is listening and they're trying to start a company, know that it will come. Almost celebrate the moment it comes. Be like, aha, I finally reached that milestone. And now that once I get through it, you know, I would have earned that badge. And now I can build a really great company. And it was great because it really pushed us to the wall. It got us to be hungrier and more experimented. All bets were off, right? We were like, man, we're going to live or die now, so it doesn't matter. And having that level of freedom to experiment was brilliant. That's exactly during those 3 months that we cracked our revenue model, our primary revenue model that still drives about 70% or 60% of our $50 million revenues today was created in those 3 months.
Definitely. Yeah, you guys had to look at what you were doing and say, what's working here and what's not.
Mm-hmm.
Was it basically with that $3 lakhs in revenue every month towards the end of 2014? Is mm-hmm. that kind of how you were able to go out to investors? I think it was a bunch of HNIs and
yeah.
Is that $1 million
no, and round? You know, I still remember I called Sashi back then and I said, Sashi, you know, the company's running out of money. We're in real deep trouble. Can you help us out? And I remember Sashi saying no at that time first because he's like, hey, you really have to figure things out. Only then will it be investable and fundable. And then it became that way. And Sashi wrote a big check, as did many other HNIs. Raj and others doubled down. Gopal Srinivasan of TVS Capital, others kind of joined in. Micromax took notice. They were anyway looking at what we are doing. They did a strategic investment of $250,000. And we hammered together $1 million of our seed capital. This is after that 3 lakh, 4 lakh a month establishment. And after that seed round was in place, obviously we made sure everybody got paid back with interest and whatnot. And that's when we started to tool up, you know, the first proper version of Healthify.me's entity. Mm. So by mid 2015 or so, we had an actual company that was now acquiring customers, building a revenue line, delivering results, driving impact, and you know started to feel and look like an actual company.
Wow!
So it took about 3 years from the kickoff of the first version of the website to getting to a real, you know, semblance of a company.
Yeah. Sort of product market
fit. Product market fit.
Yeah. That's huge.
Yeah.
And I think that's a stage where when the market is too frothy, a lot of founders miss that opportunity to actually figure out what their users actually want, their customers want. And mm-hmm. they never really get there. And then they raise a Series A, B, C, and then suddenly they're like, okay, like, now what? This isn't financially sustainable. We can't keep doing this.
Yeah.
And if the investors stop the drip feed, then they go out of business.
Absolutely. I think capital constraint is a fantastic thing, by the way. Most people underrate the value of having capital as a constraint. It drives great creativity. It really focuses you to get the product market fit right. And honestly, money is not the barrier to achieve your vision. Finding the product market fit, having that vision, being able to inspire people is really the barrier. So money usually follows, sometimes early, sometimes late, sometimes never, but it doesn't matter. And I think that was great to have that as a constraint in the first 3 years for us. And I think those memories of those first 3 years are probably some of my most precious memories at Healthify. Because things were so fluid, things were so on the edge, and I think we had a phenomenal time. I often say this to founders that they should at least wait for 1,000 days before figuring out a decision on a company, because it takes about 1,000 days of hard work, you know, assuming 10 hours a day, right? That's 10,000 hours. And you've seen the whole Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours of work at anything, and you're an expert at something. So I think at the end of 1,000 days, you're an expert, and I think you're in a good place to decide what the company's future is going to be. Some people call it a day too early, in my view, especially when the markets are too frothy. So they're like, hey, did I get investor capital? If I didn't, okay, I'm going to try something else. But I think it requires some level of perseverance to build anything great.
Yeah. Well, I think it helps too that you started quite young, you know, at 26.
Definitely.
If you're starting in your like mid-30s, you're kind of thinking...
Your time gets, you know, the pressure on time is higher, for sure. Yeah. I agree with you on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I was just giving a talk to MBA kids, and I was trying to nudge them that, you know, the 20s is the best time to start up. This is like, you know, you don't have much debt, don't have much other obligations, and it's a great time to experiment. You can always settle for a job in your 30s.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to figure out, I know at one point you and I believe Sachin went to Goa for this conference. Was that before or after the $1 million seed round?
No, it's definitely before. This is when we were scrambling for all ways of raising of figuring out any kind of capital. So one of our experiments was selling to corporates. It can be sell a corporate solution and therefore dig ourselves out of this. It was during these 3 months of no money kind of a time frame. So even getting to Goa was not so easy and needed a lot of capital. But yeah, we set up a desk at like a corporate HR conference and hoped that we can earn some revenues to cover our costs at that time. It was a brilliant experience both of us had because, you know, again, it was down to the wall and Sachin was selling our corporate services and I'd be giving a talk and I'd be trying to convince people to buy our services and whatnot. So we were doing actual on the field sales about a product. And I remember I was really hungry and I wanted to, you know, hadn't had breakfast and I wanted to grab a croissant, but that croissant was just 300 rupees, which is unaffordably expensive. So, you know, I kind of just waited till the lunchtime and that hunger was very real. And we definitely couldn't afford to stay there that night because we'd gone around staying at these seedy places. Just to be at the conference was an important thing for us.
I feel like if you approached me now and tried to sell, like if I'm the owner of a company and you've got your suit on and everything, I'd be like, sure, sign me up. But I think at that point, you guys were just, you know, just scrappy young guys.
So we'd stayed really scrappy. But you know, when we were at that conference, we'd still put on a suit jacket and you know. An uncle of mine told me that the only way to catch a lion is to look them in the eye, look it in the eye. So, you know, we definitely had a larger than life projection of Healthify at that time.
Yeah. Did you end up, were you able to sign up some clients? Because I know for a little while there you were...
For a little while, we were indeed working with a lot of corporates. And it did start off a business model for sure.
Yeah.
In fact, 2016... middle of 2016, I think corporate was half our revenues.
Yeah.
So it did start a snowball slowly, but importantly, I remember Unilever is someone that we worked with in the very early days. Philips is someone that we worked with in very early days. And I think these were people that we had met at that conference, but then followed up and then it started a bit of a revenue line for us as well. So consumer was taking off and B2B was taking off. And around middle of 2016, these were equal when we were doing, I think about 30 lakhs a month or something, we were doing half and half.
When did it become apparent, or who was the first person on the team to suggest this idea that would, I guess the first form of it would be Project Artemis. Project Amadeus,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then eventually would morph into what is now Ria, which is like a massive, like that is sort of what your business is built on now. I'd love to hear that story. And
so that was an incredibly exciting journey too. You know, we had raised our Series A. Inventus Bloom and Chirite had joined us on the basis of just the non-AI capability set. But as we scaled our business, you know, we went from 3 lakhs a month to 25 lakhs a month to close to 50 lakhs a month and then a crore a month kind of a piece, right? We realized that at that scale, it was getting increasingly hard to sustain quality and standardization by just having humans and coaches on the cloud. You know, we needed to also scale our system up to higher gross margins, make it more so that our system, our entire product offering could be more accessible. And that couldn't be done just by scaling the human coaching component. So as we were looking to raise our Series B and as we were trying and iterating with that, I remember that, it was quite apparent that the chink in our armor, the weakness was our inability to scale exponentially with technology. So we actually huddled up some of our few teammates, Anjan, quite importantly, who's now our chief business officer and practically my co-founder. And so him and I he was one of our top product managers at that time, and 3, 4, 5 of us kind of huddled up at the Royal Orchid for a week. And we said that if we have to build for the future, then whatever we've built till now is irrelevant. So if we had to reimagine what is it that we could do? And we practically ran a 1 week long hackathon towards designing a tech solution, an AI system that could handle our clients as well. And we made a lot of progress, and we figured what we had built was probably not good enough to be launched to consumers just yet, back in 2017, 2018 timeframe. But it is something that can help support our coaches much better. So, you know, the systems from it, that experiment would go on to build the diet planning tool that our coaches use the you know, the calorie counting software that we use now to design our data sets, the messaging infrastructure that we use now that our coaches use, you know, to send good specific contextual messages to our customers. So it came out of that necessity of scaling and raising a Series B, for which we needed to be a demonstratedly better tech company. And as our coaches could handle more clients because of that system, you know, we went from 50 to nearly 200 clients to a coach. Our gross margins went up to like 60% and started to look more SaaS-like. And now we found definitely it was a company that was more investable. It was a product that was more scalable. And you know, and that started running that course.
Yeah, it feels like the business at that point sort of morphed from services with a side of software to software as a service.
Yeah, that is correct. Yeah. And eventually that, you know, some of the improvements that would result in launching Rhea, which was our consumer-facing AI tool. It was sort of the ChatGPT of that time, but for just health and fitness. You know, before ChatGPT could be envisioned in 2018. It was learning from the messages that our coaches were actually sending to our clients. So in our domain, I think we had created like a GPT 1.0 for health and fitness effectively. And we started this model of software and services driving behavior change, not just services driving behavior change. So we had an AI line of business and we had a services line of business powered by AI. And that largely was our business model until fairly recently alone. Now we've added, obviously, the whole connected devices ecosystem as well, the Internet of Things, but that's how that evolved, you know. And today, about half our subscribers use only the AI system, Healthify Smart. The other half use the coaching system, you know, powered and levered by AI. But yeah, when in 2018 we were designing Iria or we were designing these systems, I don't think we could have conceptualized that this is how game-changing it would eventually be.
That's great. And I think basically the fact that you did this micro pivot and started implementing this AI set you guys up really nicely for the pandemic, mm-hmm. right? Which was a terrible event, mm-hmm. But I think probably for Healthify Me, right? A lot of people are at home feeling like they're gaining weight. They're not able to do exercise. They're not out and about.
Yeah.
And so they start looking for solutions. What was the, like, what kind of growth did you guys see from say March of 2020 until, you know, sometime into the second wave?
You know, I think initially when pandemic hit, I think every founder was in a state of shock. You know, so were we. Pretty scared. We didn't know what was going to happen. The world seemed like a very difficult place. And I still remember doing this one all hands where, you know, I literally took my guitar and everybody was remote and I sang, "Hum Honge Kamyab," you know, "We Shall Overcome." And it was quite a emotional moment for everyone. I think all of us kind of were teary-eyed while we were singing that because we were like, okay, you know, we'll get through this together. We'll be okay. But as it continued to rage on for a while, we realized that there was a significant interest increase in people trying to be healthier and fitter from their homes more so. And I think having that low-cost solution, but people were afraid of spending too much money. So having this low-cost solution, having our coaches really, really helped. And I think our nutritionists and trainers really went above and beyond during that time. I remember people who had COVID or who had family members who were having COVID, but who really went above and beyond to help out our clients virtually. We felt that we were COVID warriors too, and we had to do our bit to help our clients in this difficult time. And we were there for them. And I think the world really thanked us for that. We launched a tool called Vaccinate Me in the middle when the government released its APIs for vaccinations, even though it had nothing to do with our business. We figured we've got, you know, at that time, I think maybe 10 million or 15 million users. And it would be great if people can use a tool like Vaccinate Me to get notifications about when they can get their vaccinations. We acquired a team called Under 45, which was doing this on Telegram. We were doing it on WhatsApp. You know, we reached out to Vinod Khosla, who eventually turned into an investor and who reached out to Mark Zuckerberg, and they zero rated our WhatsApp messages. So we could indeed help the country get to their vaccination slot very quickly and efficiently. We helped vaccinate 25 million Indians in the peak of pandemic waves. And that was a hugely rewarding experience for the team. There was a small team, actually. Sumanyu, who's now a founder himself, and Manan, who's now my chief of staff, they kind of co-founded Vaccinate Me. And we just empowered them, enabled them with access to people and resources. And they just kind of built this out within days. And within 3 months, you know, 25 million people were vaccinated. So we did some amazing experiments. We had a great time. And I think came out much stronger from it than we went in. I think pandemic also helped the world realize that being healthy, being fit, taking care of your health is important. If you're overweight or if you're suffering from metabolic syndrome, likelihood of people suffering because of COVID was higher. And, you know, just like after the Spanish flu in 1930s, I think it led to a birth of many hygiene companies, you know, Reckitt-Benckiser's of the world, to scale very rapidly. I think this pandemic is going to result in a huge explosion around health and fitness.
I've heard people say, like, if you're going to start a company, strap in, it's going to be like a 7 to 10 year journey.
Mm-hmm.
And you, I mean, it's gone beyond that. And presumably, yeah, right, you're continuing to build this thing.
Yeah.
And as long as you keep that same sort of structure of, you know, perseverance, right, just sticking with it and not giving up, you know, these micro pivots every 18 months, sort of reevaluating. And I don't think it's, I mean, it feels very achievable. Like I listened to a podcast that you did a couple of years ago. You talked about healthifying a billion people.
Yes.
And that was at the beginning of my research process. And I was kind of like, okay, this guy is like an idealist. Like, what is he thinking really? But now sort of hearing the whole story, like that's totally going to happen, right?
Of course it will.
Every time you set one of those goals, you achieve it, and usually earlier than you expected.
Mm-hmm. Before the turn of the decade is the plan. We have just finished, we've just crossed 35 million. So, and you know, I still remember, you know, in the early days, 2014-15 timeframe, we used to keep our Wi-Fi password as our target for the number of users. So I remember when we were at about 10K or 12K or something, we'd kept this ambitious goal of target. The Wi-Fi password was target 50K. And then when we reached 50K, and then our goal was to change the Wi-Fi password to target 5 million. And that was a huge order of magnitude shift, right? And it seemed impossible back then. In fact, when we moved to this new office, we painted somewhere target 5 million as one of the cultural, you know, things that get said in our company. And then over time, I think people at Madurai Idli Shop and other cafes around were literally using our Wi-Fi password. And then once we raised our Series B, I think we kind of put in a real security Wi-Fi password. But we used to keep that. That was a cool cultural piece that, you know, our target was literally in the Wi-Fi password. So everybody had to, you know, really empathize with that. It became a cultural goal to set. And we just crossed our 35th million users. So, you know, we've come a long way, but there is still a long way to go. And the reason that billion is important is because at the turn of the century, we had the first time as Homo sapiens, more people overweight than underweight. We've never had that as a civilization. And that number was a billion. And in 20 years since, we've had 2.5 billion people who've become overweight. By the end of the decade, we'll have 3 billion people if left unchecked. So really our addressable market, people who need us, people who deserve to use cutting edge technologies, behavior change systems, coaches, AI to help them, is a billion people. And Nandan, my mentor, obviously, one of the times when I was asking him, his advice was always to think big. Because, you know, he said it doesn't cost anything differently if you think big or think small. So might as well think big. And if you think big, you know, even if you land short of it, it will still be huge. If you think small, then where are you going to go from there? So we've kept this audacious target of a billion. But you're right. When we kept it, I think it did seem a little too big to punch for. But now I think I'm beginning to see it in the crosshairs. And that is a powerful realization for me and the firm. I think 5 years, 6 years tops, we hope to cross that.
That was Tushar Vashisht, co-founder of Healthify Me. And remember back in 2014 when Tushar and Sachin couldn't afford to stay in that hotel in Goa and couldn't even justify the cost of a 300 rupee croissant? Well, they actually went back in 2018 with a very different outlook.
So I think 4 years later, when we had raised our 6 million A and then our 12 million B, 16 million B round, we felt that it was very important to celebrate. And I think it was a bit of exuberance, a bit of a fuck you to all the bad times we'd gone through to get there. I think we just took the whole company and we just rented the whole hotel. So we took up some, I think, 200 rooms at Siddharthi Goa or something. And did this one night of this phenomenal offsite in Goa. Oh yeah, and we served croissants for breakfast.
Thank you so much for watching or listening to the show this week, and I'll catch you in the next one.